Elliot didn't mind going to Mrs. Sen's after school. By September, the tiny beach house where he and his mother lived year-round was already cold. Elliot and his mother had to bring a portable heater along whenever they moved from one room to another, and to seal the windows with plastic sheets and a hairdryer. The beach was barren and dull to play on alone. The only neighbors who stayed on past Labor Day, a young married couple, had no children, and Elliot no longer found it interesting to gather broken mussel shells in his bucket, or to stroke the seaweed strewn like strips of emerald lasagna on the sand. Mrs. Sen's apartment was warm, sometimes too warm. The radiators continually hissed like a pressure cooker. Elliot learned to remove his sneakers first thing in Mrs. Sen's doorway and to place them on the bookcase next to a row of Mrs. Sen's slippers, each a different color, with soles as flat as cardboard and a ring of leather to hold her big toe. He especially enjoyed watching Mrs. Sen as she chopped things, seated on newspapers on the living room floor. Instead of a knife, she used a blade that curved like the prow of a Viking ship sailing to battle in distant seas. The blade was hinged at one end to a narrow wooden base. The steel, more black than silver, lacked a uniform polish, and had a serrated crest, she told Elliot, for grating. Each afternoon, Mrs. Sen lifted the blade and locked it into place so that it met the base at an angle. Facing the sharp edge without ever touching it, she took whole vegetables between her hands and hacked them apart. Cauliflower, cabbage, butternut squash. She split things in half, then quarters, speedily producing florets, cubes, slices, and shreds. She could peel a potato in seconds. At times she sat cross-legged, at times with legs splayed, surrounded by an array of colanders and shallow bowls of water in which she immersed her chopped ingredients. While she worked, she kept an eye on the television and an eye on Elliot, but she never seemed to keep an eye on the blade. Nevertheless, she refused to let Elliot walk around when she was chopping. "Just sit. Sit, please. It will just take 2 more minutes," she said, pointing to the sofa, which was draped at all times with a green and black bed cover printed with rows of elephants bearing palanquins on their backs. The daily procedure took about an hour. In order to occupy Elliot, she supplied him with the comics section of the newspaper, and crackers spread with peanut butter, and sometimes a popsicle or carrot sticks sculpted with her blade. She would have roped off the area if she could. Once, though, she broke her own rule. In need of additional supplies and reluctant to rise from the catastrophic mess that barricaded her, she asked Elliot to fetch something from the kitchen. "If you don't mind, there is a plastic bowl large enough to hold this spinach in the cabinet next to the fridge. Careful, oh dear, be careful," she cautioned as he approached. "Just leave it, thank you, on the coffee table. I can reach." She had brought the blade from India, where apparently there was at least one in every household. "Whenever there is a wedding in the family," she told Elliot one day, "or a large celebration of any kind, my mother sends out word in the evening for all the neighborhood women to bring blades just like this one. And then they sit in an enormous circle on the roof of our building, laughing and gossiping and slicing 50 kilos of vegetables through the night." Her profile hovered protectively over her work, a confetti of cucumber, eggplant, and onion skins heaped around her. "It is impossible to fall asleep those nights, listening to their chatter." She paused to look at a pine tree framed by the living room window. "Here, in this place where Mr. Sen has brought me, I cannot sometimes sleep in so much silence." Another day she sat prying the pimpled yellow fat off chicken parts, then dividing them between thigh and leg. As the bones cracked apart over the blade, her golden bangles jostled, her forearms glowed, and she exhaled audibly through her nose. At one point she paused, gripping the chicken with both hands, and stared out the window. Fat and sinew clung to her fingers. "Elliot, if I began to scream right now at the top of my lungs, would someone come?"
"Mrs. Sen, what's wrong?"
"Nothing. I'm only asking if someone would come."
Elliot shrugged. "Maybe."
"At home, that is all you have to do. Not everybody has a telephone. You just raise your voice a bit, or express grief or joy of any kind, and one whole neighborhood and half of another has come to share the news, to help with arrangements." By then, Elliot understood that when Mrs. Sen said home,
She meant India, not the apartment where she sat chopping vegetables. He thought of his own home just 5 miles away, and the young married couple who waved from time to time as they jogged at sunset along the shore. On Labor Day, they'd had a party. People were piled on the deck, eating, drinking, the sound of their laughter rising above the weary sigh of the waves. Elliot and his mother weren't invited. It was one of the rare days his mother had off, but they didn't go anywhere. She did the laundry and balanced the checkbook, and with Elliot's help, vacuumed the inside of the car. Elliot had suggested that they go through the car wash a few miles down the road, as they did every now and then, so that they could sit inside, safe and dry, as soap and water and a circle of giant canvas ribbons slapped the windshield. But his mother said she was too tired and sprayed the car with a hose. When, by evening, the crowd on the neighbor's deck began dancing, she looked up their number in the phone book and asked them to keep it down. "They might call you," Elliot said eventually to Mrs. Sen, "but they might complain that you are making too much noise." From where Elliot sat on the sofa, he could detect her curious scent of mothballs and cumin, and he could see the perfectly centered part in her braided hair, which was shaded with crushed vermilion and therefore appeared to be blushing. At first, Elliot had wondered if she had cut her scalp or if something had bitten her there. But then one day he saw her standing before the bathroom mirror, solemnly applying, with the head of a thumbtack, a fresh stroke of scarlet powder, which she stored in a small jam jar. A few grains of the powder fell onto the bridge of her nose as she used the thumbtack to stamp a dot above her eyebrows. "I must wear the powder every day," she explained when Elliot asked her what it was for the rest of the days that I am married.
"Like a wedding ring, you mean?"
"Exactly, Elliot. Exactly like a wedding ring. Only with no fear of losing it in the dishwasher." By the time Elliot's mother arrived at 6:20, Mrs. Sen always made sure all the evidence of her chopping was disposed of. The blade was scrubbed, rinsed, dried, folded, and stowed away in the cupboard with the aid of a stepladder. With Elliot's help, the newspapers were crushed with all the peels and seeds and skins inside them. Brimming bowls and colanders lined the countertop, spices and pastes were measured and blended, and eventually a collection of broths simmered over periwinkle flames on the stove. It was never a special occasion, nor was she ever expecting company. It was merely dinner for herself and Mr. Sen, as indicated by the 2 plates and 2 glasses she set, without napkins or silverware, on the square formica table at one end of the living room. As he pressed the newspapers deeper into the garbage pail, Elliot felt that he and Mrs. Sen were disobeying some unspoken rule. Perhaps it was because of the urgency with which Mrs. Sen accomplished everything, pinching salt and sugar between her fingernails, running water through lentils, sponging all imaginable surfaces, shutting cupboard doors with a series of successive clicks. It gave him a little shock to see his mother all of a sudden, in the transparent stockings and shoulder-padded suits she wore to her job, peering into the corners of Mrs. Sen's apartment. She tended to hover on the far side of the doorframe, calling to Elliot to put on his sneakers and gather his things. But Mrs. Sen would not allow it. Each evening she insisted that his mother sit on the sofa where she was served something to eat. A glass of bright pink yogurt with rose syrup, breaded mincemeat with raisins, a bowl of semolina halva. "Really, Mrs. Sen, I take a late lunch. You shouldn't go to so much trouble."
"It is no trouble. Just like Elliot, no trouble at all."
His mother nibbled Mrs. Sen's concoctions with eyes cast upward, in search of an opinion. She kept her knees pressed together, the high heels she never removed pressed into the pear-colored carpet. "It's delicious," she would conclude, setting down the plate after a bite or two. Elliot knew she didn't like the tastes. She told him so once in the car. He also knew she didn't eat lunch at work, because the first thing she did when they were back at the beach house was pour herself a glass of wine and eat bread and cheese, sometimes so much of it that she wasn't hungry for the pizza they normally ordered for dinner. She sat at the table as he ate, drinking more wine and asking how his day was, but eventually she went to the deck to smoke a cigarette, leaving Elliot to wrap up the leftovers. Each afternoon, Mrs. Sen stood in a grove of pine trees by the main road, where the school bus dropped off Elliot along with 2 or 3 other children who lived nearby. Elliot always sensed that Mrs. Sen had been waiting for some time, as if eager to greet a person she hadn't seen in years. The hair at her temples blew about in the breeze, the column of vermilion fresh in her part. She wore navy blue sunglasses a little too big for her face. Her sari, a different pattern each day, fluttered below the hem of her checkered all-weather coat. Acorns and caterpillars dotted the asphalt loop that framed the complex of about a dozen brick buildings, all identical, embedded in a communal expanse of log chips. As they walked back from the bus stop, she produced a sandwich bag from her pocket and offered Elliot the peeled wedges of an orange or lightly salted peanuts, which she had already shelled. They proceeded directly to the car, and for 20 minutes Mrs. Sen practiced driving. It was a toffee-colored sedan with vinyl seats. There was an AM radio with chrome buttons and on the ledge over the back seat, a box of Kleenex and an ice scraper. Mrs. Sen told Elliot she didn't feel right leaving him alone in the apartment, but Elliot knew she wanted him sitting beside her because she was afraid. She dreaded the roar of the ignition and placed her hands over her ears to block out the sound as she pressed her slippered feet to the gas, revving the engine. "Mr. Sen says that once I receive my license, everything will improve. What do you think, Elliot? Will things improve?"
"You could go places," Elliot suggested.
"You could go anywhere."
"Could I drive all the way to Calcutta?"
"How long would that take, Elliot? 10,000 miles at 50 miles per hour.
Elliot could not do the math in his head. He watched Mrs. Sen adjust the driver's seat, the rearview mirror, the sunglasses on top of her head. She tuned the radio to a station that played symphonies.
"Is it Beethoven?"
she asked once, pronouncing the first part of the composer's name not Bay, but Bee, like the insect. She rolled down the window on her side and asked Elliot to do the same. Eventually, she pressed her foot to the brake pedal, manipulated the automatic gear shift as if it were an enormous leaky pen, and backed inch by inch out of the parking space. She circled the apartment complex once, then once again.
"How am I doing, Elliot? Am I going to pass?"
She was continuously distracted. She stopped the car without warning to listen to something on the radio or to stare at something, anything, in the road. If she passed a person, she waved. If she saw a bird 20 feet in front of her, she beeped the horn with her index finger and waited for it to fly away. In India, she said, the driver sat on the right side, not the left. Slowly they crept past the swing set, the laundry building, the dark green trash bins, the rows of parked cars. Each time they approached the grove of pine trees where the asphalt loop met the main road, she leaned forward, pinning all her weight against the brake as cars hurtled past. It was a narrow road, painted with a solid yellow stripe, with one lane of traffic in either direction.
"Impossible, Elliot. How can I go there?"
"You need to wait until no one's coming."
"Why will not anybody slow down?"
"No one's coming now."
"But what about the car from the right? Do you see? And look, a truck is behind it. Anyway, I am not allowed on the main road without Mr. Sen."
"You have to turn and speed up fast," Elliot said. That was the way his mother did it, as if without thinking. It seemed so simple when he sat beside his mother, gliding in the evenings back to the beach house. Then the road was just a road, the other cars merely part of the scenery. But when he sat with Mrs. Sen, under an autumn sun that glowed without warmth through the trees, he saw how the same stream of cars made her knuckles pale, her wrists tremble, and her English falter.
"Everyone, these people, too much in their world."
Two things, Elliot learned, made Mrs. Sen happy. One was the arrival of a letter from her family. It was her custom to check the mailbox after driving practice. She would unlock the box, but she would ask Elliot to reach inside, telling him what to look for, and then she would shut her eyes and shield them with her hands while he shuffled through the bills and magazines that came in Mr. Sen's name. At first, Elliot found Mrs. Sen's anxiety incomprehensible. His mother had a P.O. box in town, and she collected mail so infrequently that once their electricity was cut off for 3 days. Weeks passed at Mrs. Sen's before he found a blue aerogram, grainy to the touch, crammed with stamps, showing a bald man at a spinning wheel, and blackened by postmarks.
"Is this it, Mrs. Sen?"
For the first time, she embraced him, clasping his face to her sari, surrounding him with her odor of mothballs and cumin.
she seized the letter from his hands. As soon as they were inside the apartment, she kicked off her slippers this way and that, drew a wire pin from her hair, and slit the top and sides of the aerogram in 3 strokes. Her eyes darted back and forth as she read. As soon as she was finished, she cast aside the embroidery that covered the telephone, dialed, and asked,
"Yes, is Mr. Sen there, please? It is Mrs. Sen, and it is very important."
Subsequently, she spoke in her own language, rapid and riotous to Elliot's ears. It was clear that she was reading the contents of the letter word by word. As she read, her voice was louder and seemed to shift in key. Though she stood plainly before him, Elliot had the sensation that Mrs. Sen was no longer present in the room with the pear-colored carpet. Afterward, the apartment was suddenly too small to contain her. They crossed the main road and walked a short distance to the university quadrangle, where bells in a stone tower chimed on the hour. They wandered through the student union and dragged a tray together along the cafeteria ledge, and ate French fries heaped in a cardboard boat among students chatting at circular tables. Elliot drank soda from a paper cup. Mrs. Sen steeped a tea bag with sugar and cream. After eating, they explored the art building, looking at sculptures and silk screens in cool corridors thick with the fragrance of wet paint and clay. They walked past the mathematics building, where Mr. Sen taught his classes. They ended up in the noisy, chlorine-scented wing of the athletic building, where through a wide window on the fourth floor, they watched swimmers crossing from end to end in glaring turquoise pools. Mrs. Sen took the aerogram from India out of her purse and studied the front and back. She unfolded it and reread to herself, sighing every now and then. When she had finished, she gazed for some time at the swimmers. "My sister has had a baby girl. By the time I see her, depending if Mr. Sen gets his tenure, she will be 3 years old. Her own aunt will be a stranger. If we sit side by side on a train, she will not know my face." She put away the letter, then placed a hand on Elliot's head. "Do you miss your mother, Elliot, these afternoons with me?" The thought had never occurred to him. "You must miss her. When I think of you, only a boy separated from your mother for so much of the day, I am ashamed. I see her at night. When I was your age, I was without knowing that one day I would be so far. You are wiser than that, Elliot. You already taste the way things must be." The other thing that made Mrs. Sen happy was fish from the seaside. It was always a whole fish she desired, not shellfish or the fillets Elliot's mother had broiled one night a few months ago when she invited a man from her office to dinner, a man who'd spent the night in his mother's bedroom, but whom Elliot never saw again. One evening when Elliot's mother came to pick him up, Mrs. Sen served a tuna croquette, explaining that it was really supposed to be made with a fish called baitki.
"It is very frustrating," Mrs. Sen apologized, with an emphasis on the second syllable of the word, "to live so close to the ocean and not to have so much fish."
In the summer, she said, she liked to go to a market by the beach. She added that while the fish there tasted nothing like the fish in India, at least it was fresh. Now that it was getting colder, the boats were no longer going out regularly, and sometimes there was no whole fish available for weeks at a time. "Try the supermarket," his mother suggested. Mrs. Sen shook her head. "In the supermarket, I can feed a cat 32 dinners from one of 32 tins, but I can never find a single fish I like, never a single." Mrs. Sen said she had grown up eating fish twice a day. She added that in Calcutta, people ate fish first thing in the morning, last thing before bed, as a snack after school if they were lucky. They ate the tail, the eggs, even the head. It was available in any market at any hour, from dawn until midnight. "All you have to do is leave the house and walk a bit, and there you are." Every few days, Mrs. Sen would open up the yellow pages, dial a number that she had ticked in the margin, and ask if there was any whole fish available. If so, she would ask the market to hold it.
"Under Sen, yes, S as in Sam, N as in New York. Mr. Sen will be there to pick it up."
Then she would call Mr. Sen at the university. A few minutes later, Mr. Sen would arrive, patting Elliot on the head, but not kissing Mrs. Sen. He read his mail at the formica table and drank a cup of tea before heading out. Half an hour later, he would return, carrying a paper bag with a smiling lobster drawn on the front of it, and hand it to Mrs. Sen, and head back to the university to teach his evening class. One day, when he handed Mrs. Sen the paper bag, he said,
"No more fish for a while. Cook the chicken in the freezer. I need to start holding office hours."
For the next few days, instead of calling the fish market, Mrs. Sen thawed chicken legs in the kitchen sink and chopped them with her blade. One day she made a stew with green beans and tinned sardines, but the following week the man who ran the fish market called Mrs. Sen. He assumed she wanted the fish and said he would hold it until the end of the day under her name. She was flattered.
"Isn't that nice of him, Elliot? The man said he looked up my name in the telephone book. He said there was only one Sen. Do you know how many Sens are in the Calcutta telephone book?"
She told Elliot to put on his shoes and his jacket, and then she called Mr. Sen at the university. Elliot tied his sneakers by the bookcase and waited for her to join him to choose from her row of slippers. After a few minutes, he called out her name. When Mrs. Sen did not reply, he untied his sneakers and returned to the living room, where he found her on the sofa, weeping. Her face was in her hands, and tears dripped through her fingers. Through them, she murmured something about a meeting Mr. Sen was required to attend. Slowly, she stood up and rearranged the cloth over the telephone. Elliot followed her, walking for the first time in his sneakers across the pear-colored carpet. She stared at him. Her lower eyelids were swollen into pink crests.
"Tell me, Elliot, is it too much to ask?"
Before he could answer, she took him by the hand and led him to the bedroom, whose door was normally kept shut. Apart from the bed, which lacked a headboard, the only other things in the room were a side table with a telephone on it, an ironing board, and a bureau. She flung open the drawers of the bureau and the door of the closet, filled with saris of every imaginable texture and shade, brocaded with gold and silver threads. Some were transparent, tissue thin, others as thick as drapes, with tassels knotted along the edges. In the closet, they were on hangers. In the drawers, they were folded flat or wound tightly like thick scrolls. She sifted through the drawers, letting saris spill over the edges.
"When have I ever worn this one, and this, and this?"
She tossed the saris one by one from the drawers, then pried several from their hangers. They landed like a pile of tangled sheets on the bed. The room was filled with an intense smell of mothballs.
"Send pictures," they write. "Send pictures of your new life. What picture can I send?"
She sat, exhausted, on the edge of the bed, where there was now barely room for her.
"They think I live the life of a queen, Elliot."
She looked around the blank walls of the room.
"They think I press buttons and the house is clean. They think I live in a palace."
The phone rang. Mrs. Sen let it ring several times before picking up the extension by the bed. During the conversation, she seemed only to be replying to things and wiping her face with the ends of one of her saris. When she got off the phone, she stuffed the saris without folding them back into the drawers, and then she and Elliot put on their shoes and went to the car, where they waited for Mr. Sen to meet them.
"Why don't you drive today?" Mr. Sen asked, when he appeared, rapping on the hood of the car with his knuckles.
They always spoke to each other in English when Elliot was present.
"Not today. Another day."
"How do you expect to pass the test if you refuse to drive on a road with other cars?"
"Elliot is here today."
"He is here every day. It's for your own good. Elliot, tell Mrs. Sen it's for her own good."
She refused. They drove in silence along the same roads that Elliot and his mother took back to the beach house each evening. But in the back seat of Mr. and Mrs. Sen's car, the ride seemed unfamiliar and took longer than usual. The gulls, whose tedious cries woke him each morning, now thrilled him as they dipped and flapped across the sky. They passed one beach after another, and the shacks, now locked up, that sold frozen lemonade and quahogs in summer. Only one of the shacks was open. It was the fish market. Mrs. Sen unlocked her door and turned toward Mr. Sen, who had not yet unfastened his seatbelt.
"Are you coming?"
Mr. Sen handed her some bills from his wallet.
"I have a meeting in 20 minutes, he said, staring at the dashboard as he spoke. "Please don't waste time."
Elliot accompanied her into the dank little shop, whose walls were festooned with nets and fish and buoys.
A group of tourists with cameras around their necks, huddled by the counter, some sampling stuffed clams, others pointing to a large chart illustrating 50 different varieties of North Atlantic fish. Mrs. Sen took a ticket from the machine at the counter and waited in line. Elliot stood by the lobsters, which stirred one on top of another in their murky tank, their claws bound by yellow rubber bands. He watched as Mrs. Sen laughed and chatted when it was her turn in line, with a man with a bright red face and yellow teeth, dressed in a black rubber apron. In either hand, he held a mackerel by the tail.
"You are sure what you are selling me is very fresh?"
"Any fresher and they'd answer that question themselves."
The dial shivered toward its verdict on the scale.
"You want this cleaned, Mrs. Sen?"
She nodded.
"Leave the heads on, please."
"You got cats at home?"
"No cats, only a husband."
Later in the apartment, she pulled the blade out of the cupboard, spread newspapers across the carpet, and inspected her treasures. One by one, she drew them from the paper wrapping, wrinkled and tinged with blood. She stroked the tails, prodded the bellies, pried apart the gutted flesh. With a pair of scissors, she clipped the fins. She tucked a finger under the gills, a red so bright they made her vermilion seem pale. She grasped the body, lined with inky streaks at either end, and notched it at intervals against the blade.
"Why do you do that?"
Elliot asked.
"To see how many pieces. If I cut properly from this fish, I will get 3 meals.
She sawed off the head and set it on a pie plate. In November came a series of days when Mrs. Sen refused to practice driving. The blade never emerged from the cupboard. Newspapers were not spread on the floor. She did not call the fish store, nor did she thaw chicken. In silence, she prepared crackers with peanut butter for Elliot, then sat reading old aerograms from a shoebox. When it was time for Elliot to leave, she gathered together his things without inviting his mother to sit on the sofa and eat something first. When eventually his mother asked him in the car if he'd noticed a change in Mrs. Sen's behavior, he said he hadn't. He didn't tell her that Mrs. Sen paced the apartment, staring at the plastic-covered lampshades as if noticing them for the first time. He didn't tell her that she switched on the television but never watched it, or that she made herself tea but let it grow cold on the coffee table. One day, she played a tape of something she called a raga. It sounded a little bit like someone plucking very slowly and then very quickly on a violin. And Mrs. Sen said it was supposed to be heard only in the late afternoon as the sun was setting. As the music played for nearly an hour, she sat on the sofa with her eyes closed. Afterward, she said,
"It is more sad even than your Beethoven, isn't it?"
Another day, she played a cassette of people talking in her language, a farewell present, she told Elliot, that her family had made for her. As the succession of voices laughed and said their bit, Mrs. Sen identified each speaker.
"My third uncle, my cousin, my father, my grandfather."
One speaker sang a song, another recited a poem. The final voice on the tape belonged to Mrs. Sen's mother. It was quieter and sounded more serious than the others. There was a pause between each sentence, and during this pause, Mrs. Sen translated for Elliot.
"The price of goat rose 2 rupees.
The mangoes at the market are not very sweet. College Street is flooded."
She turned off the tape.
"These are things that happened the day I left India."
The next day she played the same cassette all over again. This time, when her grandfather was speaking, she stopped the tape. She told Elliot she'd received a letter over the weekend. Her grandfather was dead. A week later, Mrs. Sen began cooking again. One day, as she sat slicing cabbage on the living room floor, Mr. Sen called. He wanted to take Elliot and Mrs. Sen to the seaside. For the occasion, Mrs. Sen put on a red sari and red lipstick. She freshened the vermilion in her part and rebraided her hair. She knotted a scarf under her chin, arranged her sunglasses on top of her head, and put a pocket camera in her purse. As Mr. Sen backed out of the parking lot, he put his arm across the top of the front seat so that it looked as if he had his arm around Mrs. Sen.
"It's getting too cold for that top coat," he said to her at one point. "We should get you something warmer."
At the shop, they bought mackerel and butterfish and sea bass. This time, Mr. Sen came into the shop with them. It was Mr. Sen who asked whether the fish was fresh and to cut it this way or that way. They bought so much fish that Elliot had to hold one of the bags. After they put the bags in the trunk, Mr. Sen announced that he was hungry, and Mrs. Sen agreed, so they crossed the street to a restaurant where the takeout window was still open. They sat at a picnic table and ate two baskets of clam cakes. Mrs. Sen put a good deal of Tabasco sauce and black pepper on hers.
Like pakoras, no?
Her face was flushed, her lipstick faded, and she laughed at everything Mr. Sen said. Behind the restaurant was a small beach, and when they were done eating, they walked for a while along the shore, into a wind so strong they had to walk backward. Mrs. Sen pointed to the water and said that at a certain moment, each wave resembled a sari drying on a clothesline.
Impossible!
She shouted eventually, laughing as she turned back, her eyes teary.
I cannot move.
Instead, she took a picture of Elliot and Mr. Sen standing on the sand.
Now one of us,
she said, pressing Elliot against her checkered coat and giving the camera to Mr. Sen. Finally, the camera was given to Elliot. Hold it steady, said Mr. Sen. Elliot looked through the tiny window in the camera and waited for Mr. and Mrs. Sen to move closer together, but they didn't. They didn't hold hands or put their arms around each other's waists. Both smiled with their mouths closed, squinting into the wind, Mrs. Sen's red sari leaping like flames under her coat. In the car, warm at last and exhausted from the wind and the clam cakes, they admired the dunes, the ships they could see in the distance, the view of the lighthouse, the peach and purple sky. After a while, Mr. Sen slowed down and stopped by the side of the road.
What's wrong? Mrs. Sen asked.
You are going to drive home today.
Not today.
Yes, today.
Mr. Sen stepped out of the car and opened the door on Mrs. Sen's side. A fierce wind blew into the car, accompanied by the sound of waves crashing on the shore. Finally, she slid over to the driver's side, but spent a long time adjusting her sari and her sunglasses. Elliot turned and looked through the back window. The road was empty. Mrs. Sen turned on the radio, filling up the car with violin music.
There's no need, Mr. Sen said, clicking it off.
It helps me to concentrate,
Mrs. Sen said, and turned the radio on again.
Put on your signal, Mr. Sen directed.
I know what to do.
For about a mile she was fine, though far slower than the other cars that passed her. But when the town approached, and traffic lights loomed on wires in the distance, she went even slower.
Switch lanes, Mr. Sen said. You will have to bear left at the rotary.
Mrs. Sen did not.
Switch lanes, I tell you.
He shut off the radio.
Are you listening to me?
A car beeped its horn, then another. She beeped defiantly in response, stopped, then pulled without signaling to the side of the road.
No more,
she said, her forehead resting against the top of the steering wheel.
I hate it. I hate driving. I won't go on.
She stopped driving after that. The next time the fish store called, she did not call Mr. Sen at his office. She had decided to try something new. There was a town bus that ran on an hourly schedule between the university and the seaside. After the university, it made two stops, first at a nursing home, then at a shopping plaza without a name, which consisted of a bookstore, a shoe store, a drug store, a pet store, and a record store. On benches under the portico, elderly women from the nursing home sat in pairs, in knee-length overcoats with oversized buttons, eating lozenges.
Elliot, Mrs. Sen asked him while they were sitting on the bus, will you put your mother in a nursing home when she is old?
Maybe, he said, but I would visit every day.
You say that now, but you will see when you are a man, your life will be in places you cannot know now.
She counted on her fingers.
You will have a wife and children of your own, and they will want to be driven to different places at the same time. No matter how kind they are, one day they will complain about visiting your mother. And you will get tired of it too, Elliot. You will miss one day and another, and then she will have to drag herself onto a bus just to get herself a bag of lozenges.
At the fish shop, the ice beds were nearly empty, as were the lobster tanks, where rust-colored stains were visible through the water. A sign said the shop would be closing for winter at the end of the month. There was only one person working behind the counter, a young boy who did not recognize Mrs. Sen as he handed her a bag reserved under her name.
"Has it been cleaned and scaled?"
Mrs. Sen asked. The boy shrugged. "My boss left early. He just said to give you this bag." In the parking lot, Mrs. Sen consulted the bus schedule. They would have to wait 45 minutes for the next one. And so they crossed the street and bought clam cakes at the takeout window they had been to before. There was no place to sit. The picnic tables were no longer in use, their benches chained upside down on top of them. On the way home, an old woman on the bus kept watching them, her eyes shifting from Mrs. Sen to Elliot to the blood-lined bag between their feet. She wore a black overcoat, and in her lap she held, with gnarled, colorless hands, a crisp white bag from the drugstore. The only other passengers were two college students, boyfriend and girlfriend, wearing matching sweatshirts, their fingers linked, slouched in the back seat. In silence, Elliot and Mrs. Sen ate the last few clam cakes in the bag. Mrs. Sen had forgotten napkins, and traces of fried batter dotted the corners of her mouth. When they reached the nursing home, the woman in the overcoat stood up, said something to the driver, then stepped off the bus. The driver turned his head and glanced back at Mrs. Sen.
"What's in the bag?"
Mrs. Sen looked up, startled.
"Speak English?"
The bus began to move again, causing the driver to look at Mrs. Sen and Elliot in his enormous rearview mirror.
"Yes, I can speak."
"Then what's in the bag?"
"A fish," Mrs. Sen replied.
"The smell seems to be bothering the other passengers. Kid, maybe you should open her window or something."
One afternoon, a few days later, the phone rang. Some very tasty halibut had arrived on the boats. Would Mrs. Sen like to pick one up? She called Mr. Sen, but he was not at his desk. A second time she tried calling, then a third. Eventually she went to the kitchen and returned to the living room with the blade, an eggplant, and some newspapers. Without having to be told, Elliot took his place on the sofa and watched as she sliced the stems off the eggplant. She divided it into long, slender strips, then into small squares, smaller and smaller, as small as sugar cubes.
"I am going to put these in a very tasty stew with fish and green bananas," she announced. "Only I will have to do without the green bananas."
"Are we going to get the fish?"
"We are going to get the fish."
"Is Mr. Sen going to take us?"
"Put on your shoes."
They left the apartment without cleaning up. Outside it was so cold that Elliot could feel the chill on his teeth. They got in the car and Mrs. Sen drove around the asphalt loop several times. Each time she paused by the grove of pine trees to observe the traffic on the main road. Elliot thought she was just practicing while they waited for Mr. Sen. But then she gave a signal and turned. The accident occurred quickly. After about a mile, Mrs. Sen took a left before she should have. And though the oncoming car managed to swerve out of her way, she was so startled by the horn that she lost control of the wheel and hit a telephone pole on the opposite corner. A policeman arrived and asked to see her license, but she did not have one to show him.
"Mr. Sen teaches mathematics at the university," was all she said by way of explanation.
The damage was slight. Mrs. Sen cut her lip. Elliot complained briefly of a pain in his ribs, and the car's fender would have to be straightened. The policeman thought Mrs. Sen had also cut her scalp, but it was only the vermilion. When Mr. Sen arrived, driven by one of his colleagues, he spoke at length with the policeman as he filled out some forms. But he said nothing to Mrs. Sen as he drove them back to the apartment. When they got out of the car, Mr. Sen patted Elliot's head.
"The policeman said you were lucky. Very lucky to come out without a scratch."
After taking off her slippers and putting them on the bookcase, Mrs. Sen put away the blade that was still on the living room floor and threw the eggplant pieces and the newspapers into the garbage pail. She prepared a plate of crackers with peanut butter, placed them on the coffee table, and turned on the television for Elliot's benefit.
"If he is still hungry, give him a popsicle from the box in the freezer," she said to Mr. Sen, who sat at the formica table sorting through the mail.
Then she went into the bedroom and shut the door. When Elliot's mother arrived at 5:45, Mr. Sen told her the details of the accident and offered a check reimbursing November's payment. As he wrote out the check, he apologized on behalf of Mrs. Sen. He said she was resting, though when Elliot had gone to the bathroom, he'd heard her crying.
His mother was satisfied with the arrangement, and in a sense, she confessed to Elliot as they drove home, she was relieved. It was the last afternoon Elliot spent with Mrs. Sen, or with any babysitter. From then on, his mother gave him a key, which he wore on a string around his neck. He was to call the neighbors in case of an emergency, and to let himself into the beach house after school. The first day, just as he was taking off his coat, the phone rang. It was his mother calling from her office. "You're a big boy now, Elliot," she told him. "You okay?" Elliot looked out the kitchen window at gray waves receding from the shore and said that he was fine. This Blessed House. They discovered the first one in a cupboard above the stove, beside an unopened bottle of malt vinegar.
"Guess what I found?"
Twinkle walked into the living room, lined from end to end with taped-up packing boxes, waving the vinegar in one hand and a white porcelain effigy of Christ, roughly the same size as the vinegar bottle, in the other. Sanjeev looked up. He was kneeling on the floor, marking, with ripped bits of a post-it, patches on the baseboard that needed to be retouched with paint.
"Throw it away."
"Which?"
"Both."
"But I can cook something with the vinegar. It's brand new."
"You've never cooked anything with vinegar."
"I'll look it up, in one of those books we got for our wedding."
Sanjeev turned back to the baseboard to replace a post-it scrap that had fallen to the floor.
"Check the expiration, and at the very least, get rid of that idiotic statue."
"But it could be worth something. Who knows?"
She turned it upside down, then stroked with her index finger the minuscule frozen folds of its robe.
"It's pretty."
"We're not Christian," Sanjeev said.
Lately, he had begun noticing the need to state the obvious to Twinkle. The day before, he had to tell her that if she dragged her end of the bureau instead of lifting it, the parquet floor would scratch. She shrugged.
"No, we're not Christian. We're good little Hindus."
She planted a kiss on top of Christ's head, then placed the statue on top of the fireplace mantel, which needed, Sanjeev observed, to be dusted. By the end of the week, the mantle still had not been dusted. It had, however, come to serve as the display shelf for a sizable collection of Christian paraphernalia. There was a 3D postcard of St. Francis done in four colors, which Twinkle had found taped to the back of the medicine cabinet, and a wooden cross keychain, which Sanjeev had stepped on with bare feet as he was installing extra shelving in Twinkle's study. There was a framed paint-by-number of the three wise men against a black velvet background tucked in the linen closet. There was also a tile trivet depicting a blonde, unbearded Jesus delivering a sermon on a mountaintop, left in one of the drawers of the built-in china cabinet in the dining room.
"Do you think the previous owners were born-agains?"
asked Twinkle, making room the next day for a small plastic snow-filled dome containing a miniature nativity scene, found behind the pipes of the kitchen sink. Sanjeev was organizing his engineering texts from MIT in alphabetical order on a bookshelf, though it had been several years since he had needed to consult any of them. After graduating, he moved from Boston to Connecticut to work for a firm near Hartford, and he had recently learned that he was being considered for the position of vice president. At 33, he had a secretary of his own and a dozen people working under his supervision who gladly supplied him with any information he needed. Still, the presence of his college books in the room reminded him of a time in his life he recalled with fondness, when he would walk each evening across the Mass Avenue Bridge to order moulai chicken with spinach from his favorite Indian restaurant on the other side of the Charles, and return to his dorm to write out clean copies of his problem sets.
"Or perhaps it's an attempt to convert people," Twinkle mused.
"Clearly the scheme has succeeded in your case."
She disregarded him, shaking the little plastic dome so that the snow swirled over the manger. He studied the items on the mantel. It puzzled him that each was in its own way so silly. Clearly they lacked a sense of sacredness. He was further puzzled that Twinkle, who normally displayed good taste, was so charmed. These objects meant something to Twinkle, but they meant nothing to him. They irritated him.
"We should call the realtor. Tell him there's all this nonsense left behind. Tell him to take it away."
"Oh, Sanj," Twinkle groaned.
please, I would feel terrible throwing them away. Obviously, they were important to the people who used to live here. It would feel, I don't know, sacrilegious or something.
If they're so precious, then why are they hidden all over the house? Why didn't they take them with them?
There must be others, Twinkle said. Her eyes roamed the bare off-white walls of the room as if there were other things concealed behind the plaster. What else do you think we'll find?
But as they unpacked their boxes and hung up their winter clothes and the silk paintings of elephant processions bought on their honeymoon in Jaipur, Twinkle, much to her dismay, could not find a thing. Nearly a week had passed before they discovered, one Saturday afternoon, a larger-than-life-sized watercolor poster of Christ, weeping translucent tears the size of peanut shells and sporting a crown of thorns, rolled up behind a radiator in the guest bedroom. Sanjeev had mistaken it for a window shade.
Oh, we must! We simply must put it up! It's too spectacular!
Twinkle lit a cigarette and began to smoke it with relish, waving it around Sanjeev's head, as if it were a conductor's baton, as Mahler's Fifth Symphony roared from the stereo downstairs.
Now look, I will tolerate, for now, your little biblical menagerie in the living room. But I refuse to have this, he said, flicking at one of the painted peanut tears, displayed in our home.
Twinkle stared at him, placidly exhaling, the smoke emerging in two thin blue streams from her nostrils. She rolled up the poster slowly, securing it with one of the elastic bands she always wore around her wrist for tying back her thick, unruly hair, streaked here and there with henna.
I'm going to put it in my study, she informed him. That way you don't have to look at it.
What about the housewarming? They'll want to see all the rooms. I've invited people from the office.
She rolled her eyes. Sanjeev noted that the symphony, now in its third movement, had reached a crescendo, for it pulsed with the telltale clashing of cymbals.
I'll put it behind the door, she offered. That way, when they peek in, they won't see. Happy?
He stood watching her as she left the room, with her poster and her cigarette. A few ashes had fallen to the floor where she'd been standing. He bent down, pinched them between his fingers, and deposited them in his cupped palm. The tender fourth movement, the Adagietto, began. During breakfast, Sanjeev had read in the liner notes that Mahler had proposed to his wife by sending her the manuscript of this portion of the score. Although there were elements of tragedy and struggle in the Fifth Symphony he had read, it was principally music of love and happiness. He heard the toilet flush.
By the way, Twinkle hollered, if you want to impress people, I wouldn't play this music. It's putting me to sleep.
Sanjeev went to the bathroom to throw away the ashes. The cigarette butt still bobbed in the toilet bowl, but the tank was refilling, so he had to wait a moment before he could flush it again. In the mirror of the medicine cabinet, he inspected his long eyelashes. Like a girl's, Twinkle liked to tease. Though he was of average build, his cheeks had a plumpness to them. This, along with the eyelashes, detracted, he feared, from what he hoped was a distinguished profile. He was of average height as well, and had wished ever since he had stopped growing that he were just 1 inch taller. For this reason, it irritated him when Twinkle insisted on wearing high heels, as she had done the other night when they ate dinner in Manhattan. This was the first weekend after they'd moved into the house. By then, the mantle had already filled up considerably, and they had bickered about it in the car on the way down. But then, Twinkle had drunk 4 glasses of whiskey in a nameless bar in Alphabet City, and forgot all about it. She dragged him to a tiny bookshop on St. Mark's Place, where she browsed for nearly an hour, and when they left, she insisted that they dance a tango on the sidewalk in front of strangers. Afterward, she tottered on his arm, rising faintly over his line of vision, in a pair of suede 3-inch leopard print pumps. In this manner, they walked the endless blocks back to a parking garage on Washington Square, for Sanjeev had heard far too many stories about the terrible things that happened to cars in Manhattan.
But I do nothing all day except sit at my desk, she fretted when they were driving home, after he had mentioned that her shoes looked uncomfortable, and suggested that perhaps she should not wear them. I can't exactly wear heels when I'm typing. though he abandoned the argument, he knew for a fact that she didn't spend all day at her desk. Just that afternoon, when he got back from a run, he found her inexplicably in bed, reading. When he asked why she was in bed in the middle of the day, she told him she was bored. He had wanted to say to her then, "You could unpack some boxes. You could sweep the attic. You could retouch the paint on the bathroom windowsill, and after you do it, you could warn me so that I wouldn't put my watch on it." They didn't bother her, these scattered, unsettled matters. She seemed content with whatever clothes she found at the front of the closet, with whatever magazine was lying around, with whatever song was on the radio. Content, yet curious. And now all of her curiosity centered around discovering the next treasure. A few days later, when Sanjeev returned from the office, he found Twinkle on the telephone, smoking and talking to one of her girlfriends in California, even though it was before 5 o'clock, and the long-distance rates were at their peak. "Highly devout people," she was saying, pausing every now and then to exhale. "Each day is like a treasure hunt. I'm serious. This you won't believe. The switch plates in the bedrooms were decorated with scenes from the Bible. You know, Noah's Ark and all that. 3 bedrooms, but one is my study. Sanjeev went to the hardware store right away and replaced them. Can you imagine? He replaced every single one." Now it was the friend's turn to talk. Twinkle nodded, slouched on the floor in front of the fridge, wearing black stirrup pants and a yellow chenille sweater, groping for her lighter. Sanjeev could smell something aromatic on the stove, and he picked his way carefully across the extra-long phone cord tangled on the Mexican terracotta tiles. He opened the lid of a pot with a sort of reddish-brown sauce dripping over the sides, boiling furiously. "It's a stew I made with fish. I put the vinegar in it," she said to him, interrupting her friend, crossing her fingers. "Sorry, you were saying?" She was like that, excited and delighted by little things, crossing her fingers before any remotely unpredictable event, like tasting a new flavor of ice cream or dropping a letter in a mailbox. It was a quality he did not understand. It made him feel stupid, as if the world contained hidden wonders he could not anticipate or see. He looked at her face, which, it occurred to him, had not grown out of its girlhood, the eyes untroubled, the pleasing features unfirm, as if they still had to settle into some sort of permanent expression. Nicknamed after a nursery rhyme, she had yet to shed the childhood endearment. Now, in the second month of their marriage, certain things nettled him. The way she sometimes spat a little when she spoke, or left her undergarments after removing them at night, at the foot of their bed, rather than depositing them in the laundry hamper. They had met only 4 months before. Her parents, who lived in California, and his, who still lived in Calcutta, were old friends, and across continents they had arranged the occasion at which Twinkle and Sanjeev were introduced, a 16th birthday party for a daughter in their circle, when Sanjeev was in Palo Alto on business. At the restaurant, they were seated side by side at a round table with a revolving platter of spare ribs and egg rolls and chicken wings, which, they concurred, all tasted the same. They had concurred, too, on their adolescent but still persistent fondness for Wodehouse novels and their dislike for the sitar. And later, Twinkle confessed that she was charmed by the way Sanjeev had dutifully refilled her teacup during their conversation. And so the phone calls began and grew longer. And then the visits, first he to Stanford, then she to Connecticut, after which Sanjeev would save in an ashtray left on the balcony the crushed cigarettes she had smoked during the weekend. Saved them, that is, until the next time she came to visit him. And then he vacuumed the apartment, washed the sheets, even dusted the plant leaves in her honor. She was 27, and recently abandoned, he had gathered, by an American who had tried and failed to be an actor. Sanjeev was lonely, with an excessively generous income for a single man, and had never been in love. At the urging of their matchmakers, they married in India, amid hundreds of well-wishers whom he barely remembered from his childhood, in incessant August rains, under a red and orange tent strung with Christmas tree lights on Mandeville Road. "Did you sweep the attic?" he asked Twinkle later as she was folding paper napkins and wedging them by their plates. The attic was the only part of the house they had not yet given an initial cleaning.
"Not yet. I will, I promise.
I hope this tastes good, she said, planting the steaming pot on top of the Jesus trivet. There was a loaf of Italian bread in a little basket, and iceberg lettuce and grated carrots tossed with bottled dressing and croutons, and glasses of red wine. She was not terribly ambitious in the kitchen. She bought pre-roasted chickens from the supermarket and served them with potato salad prepared who knew when, sold in little plastic containers. Indian food, she complained, was a bother. She detested chopping garlic and peeling ginger and could not operate a blender, and so it was Sanjeev who, on weekends, seasoned mustard oil with cinnamon sticks and cloves in order to produce a proper curry. He had to admit, though, that whatever it was that she had cooked today, it was unusually tasty, attractive even, with bright white cubes of fish and flecks of parsley and fresh tomatoes gleaming in the dark brown-red broth.
How did you make it?
I made it up.
What did you do?
I just put some things into the pot and added the malt vinegar at the end.
How much vinegar?
She shrugged, ripping off some bread and plunging it into her bowl.
What do you mean you don't know? You should write it down. What if you need to make it again, for a party or something?
I'll remember, she said. She covered the bread basket with a dish towel that had, he suddenly noticed, the Ten Commandments printed on it. She flashed him a smile, giving his knee a little squeeze under the table. Face it, this house is blessed. The housewarming party was scheduled for the last Saturday in October, and they had invited about 30 people. All were Sanjeev's acquaintances, people from the office, and a number of Indian couples in the Connecticut area, many of whom he barely knew, but who had regularly invited him in his bachelor days to supper on Saturdays. He often wondered why they included him in their circle. He had little in common with any of them, but he always attended their gatherings to eat spiced chickpeas and shrimp cutlets and gossip and discuss politics, for he seldom had other plans. So far, no one had met Twinkle. Back when they were still dating, Sanjeev didn't want to waste their brief weekends together with people he associated with being alone. Other than Sanjeev and an ex-boyfriend who she believed worked in a pottery studio in Brookfield, she knew no one in the state of Connecticut. She was completing her master's thesis at Stanford, a study of an Irish poet whom Sanjeev had never heard of. Sanjeev had found the house on his own before leaving for the wedding, for a good price, in a neighborhood with a fine school system. He was impressed by the elegant curved staircase with its wrought iron banister and the dark wooden wainscoting, and the solarium overlooking rhododendron bushes, and the solid brass 22, which also happened to be the date of his birth, nailed impressively to the vaguely Tudor facade. There were two working fireplaces, a two-car garage, and an attic suitable for converting into extra bedrooms if, the realtor mentioned, the need should arise. By then, Sanjeev had already made up his mind, was determined that he and Twinkle should live there together forever, and so he had not bothered to notice the switch plates covered with biblical stickers, or the transparent decal of the Virgin on the half shell, as Twinkle liked to call it, adhered to the window in the master bedroom. When, after moving in, he tried to scrape it off, he scratched the glass. The weekend before the party, they were raking the lawn when he heard Twinkle shriek. He ran to her, clutching his rake, worried that she had discovered a dead animal or a snake. A brisk October breeze stung the tops of his ears as his sneakers crunched over brown and yellow leaves. When he reached her, she had collapsed on the grass, dissolved in nearly silent laughter. Behind an overgrown forsythia bush was a plaster Virgin Mary as tall as their waists, with a blue-painted hood draped over her head in the manner of an Indian bride. Twinkle grabbed the hem of her T-shirt and began wiping away the dirt staining the statue's brow.
"I suppose you want to put her by the foot of our bed," Sanjeev said.
She looked at him, astonished. Her belly was exposed, and he saw that there were goosebumps around her navel. "What do you think? Of course we can't put her in our bedroom."
We can't?
No, silly Sanj. This is meant for outside, for the lawn.
Oh, God, no, Twinkle, no.
But we must. It would be bad luck not to.
All the neighbors will see. They'll think we're insane.
Why?
for having a statue of the Virgin Mary on our lawn? Every other person in this neighborhood has a statue of Mary on the lawn. We'll fit right in.
We're not Christian.
So you keep reminding me.
She spat onto the tip of her finger and started to rub intently at a particularly stubborn stain on Mary's chin.
Do you think this is dirt or some kind of fungus?
He was getting nowhere with her, with this woman whom he had known for only 4 months and whom he had married, this woman with whom he now shared his life. He thought with a flicker of regret of the snapshots his mother used to send him from Calcutta, of prospective brides who could sing and sew and season lentils without consulting a cookbook. Sanjeev had considered these women, had even ranked them in order of preference. But then he had met Twinkle.
Twinkle, I can't have the people I work with see this statue on my lawn.
They can't fire you for being a believer. It would be discrimination.
That's not the point.
What does it matter to you so much what other people think?
Twinkle, please.
He was tired. He let his weight rest against his rake as she began dragging the statue toward an oval bed of myrtle beside the lamppost that flanked the brick pathway.
Look, Sanj, she's so lovely.
He returned to his pile of leaves and began to deposit them by handfuls into a plastic garbage bag. Over his head, the blue sky was cloudless. One tree on the lawn was still full of leaves, red and orange, like the tent in which he had married Twinkle. He did not know if he loved her. He said he did when she had first asked him, one afternoon in Palo Alto as they sat side by side in a darkened, nearly empty movie theater. Before the film, one of her favorites, something in German that he found extremely depressing, she had pressed the tip of her nose to his so that he could feel the flutter of her mascara-coated eyelashes. That afternoon, he had replied yes, he loved her, and she was delighted and fed him a piece of popcorn, letting her finger linger an instant between his lips, as if it were his reward for coming up with the right answer. Though she did not say it herself, he assumed that she had loved him too. But now he was no longer sure. In truth, Sanjeev did not know what love was, only what he thought it was not. It was not, he had decided, returning to an empty, carpeted condominium each night, and using only the top fork in his cutlery drawer, and turning away politely at those weekend dinner parties when the other men eventually put their arms around the waists of their wives and girlfriends, leaning over every now and again to kiss their shoulders or necks. It was not sending away for classical music CDs by mail, working his way methodically through the major composers that the catalog recommended, and always sending his payments in on time. In the months before meeting Twinkle, Sanjeev had begun to realize this.
You have enough money in the bank to raise 3 families, his mother reminded him when they spoke at the start of each month on the phone. You need a wife to look after and love.
Now he had one, a pretty one, from a suitably high caste who would soon have a master's degree. What was there not to love? That evening, Sanjeev poured himself a gin and tonic, drank it, and most of another during one segment of the news, and then approached Twinkle, who was taking a bubble bath, for she announced that her limbs ached from raking the lawn, something she had never done before. He didn't knock. She had applied a bright blue mask to her face, was smoking and sipping some bourbon with ice, and leafing through a fat paperback book whose pages had buckled and turned gray from the water. He glanced at the cover. The only thing written on it was the word "Sonnets" in dark red letters. He took a breath, and then he informed her very calmly that after finishing his drink, he was going to put on his shoes and go outside and remove the Virgin from the front lawn.
Where are you going to put it?
She asked him dreamily, her eyes closed. One of her legs emerged, unfolding gracefully from the layers of suds. She flexed and pointed her toes.
For now, I'm going to put it in the garage. Then tomorrow morning, on my way to work, I'm going to take it to the dump.
Don't you dare!
She stood up, letting the book fall into the water, bubbles dripping down her thighs.
I hate you,
she informed him, her eyes narrowing at the word hate. She reached for her bathrobe,
tied it tightly about her waist, and padded down the winding staircase, leaving sloppy, wet footprints along the parquet floor. When she reached the foyer, Sanjeev said,
"Are you planning on leaving the house that way?"
He felt a throbbing in his temples, and his voice revealed an unfamiliar snarl when he spoke.
"Who cares? Who cares what way I leave this house?"
"Where are you planning on going at this hour?"
"You can't throw away that statue. I won't let you."
Her mask, now dry, had assumed an ashen quality, and the water from her hair dripped onto the caked contours of her face.
"Yes, I can. I will."
"No,"
Twinkle said, her voice suddenly small.
"This is our house. We own it together. The statue is a part of our property."
She had begun to shiver. A small pool of bathwater had collected around her ankles. He went to shut a window, fearing that she would catch cold. Then he noticed that some of the water dripping down her hard blue face was tears.
"Oh, God, Twinkle, please, I didn't mean it."
He had never seen her cry before, had never seen such sadness in her eyes. She didn't turn away or try to stop the tears. Instead, she looked strangely at peace. For a moment, she closed her lids, pale and unprotected compared to the blue that caked the rest of her face. Sanjeev felt ill, as if he had eaten either too much or too little. She went to him, placing her damp, toweled arms about his neck, sobbing into his chest, soaking his shirt. The mask flaked onto his shoulders. In the end, they settled on a compromise. The statue would be placed in a recess at the side of the house, so that it wasn't obvious to passers-by, but was still clearly visible to all who came.